Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the Vice Magazine podcast, your definitive guide to enlightening information. For the final installment of our music issue coverage, I invited some of our editors to discuss how technology has changed the state of the music industry today. I remember celebrating a birthday when I was younger. I probably had just turned 9 or 10 years old, and a friend gifted me Salt-N-Pepa's Very Necessary CD. The problem was I only had a Walkman, so I had to exchange the CD for a tape. For those of us who grew up in the 90s, this was the norm. You saved your allowance, bought a CD, and listened to it on repeat. Fast forward to today, and the technology now lets us access millions of songs with the touch of a button. But are these advancements hurting or helping us? I spoke to three Vice editors for their thoughts.
Okay, why doesn't everyone start by introducing themselves?
Hi, my name is Emily Friedlander. I am a senior editor for Vice Digital and formerly the editor-in-chief of Thump.
This is Dan Ozzy. I write about music for Noisy.com, the website.
My name's Eric Sunderman, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Noisy.com,
the website.
Noisy.com.
So, with the music issue coming out in November, and a lot of the stories have to do with technology and its effect on the music industry, whether that's good or bad. I guess the first question is, in the age of streaming with Spotify and Apple Music and those kind of sites, where you have access to everything all at once, how do you figure out what to listen to? And how does that process different than maybe like 10 years ago?
Well, I read it on Noisy.
Great answer. Just want to say.
I think that I look to social media a lot. I think Twitter is still a good source for like what people are talking about or what's new. I subscribe to various playlists. I use Apple Music personally. And then honestly, just word of mouth still. Like there's people whose specific opinions that I trust, and there are writers and editors across the internet and publications that I follow. If Pitchfork gives best new music, I listen to it. Like there's a lot of weight still carried by that. But I don't know if I edit a music website, so I don't know if I'm like a normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're the worst people to ask.
Does that process differ than it was 10 years ago then for you guys? I mean, obviously, you guys, I think, have all been writing about music for a long time.
I would go to my local record store and befriend the clerks there and talk to them because they always had the best taste. Or I would pick up print magazines like Spin and Rolling Stone or Fader and read what they were writing about and then decide what to buy based on the reviews there.
I was thinking about this a lot lately, about how much the omnipresent internet has just changed how I appreciate music too, not just how I consume it. Because like when I was 14-year-old kid, buying a CD was a big investment. Like $15 was a lot of money when you're in high school, you know? And so anything that I bought, it would be stuff that I might not even have heard prior to buying it, which seems like a crazy act now to just go buy something you've never heard anything of. And if I put $15 in it, I was going to find something that I liked about it. Like nobody like works for music anymore. It's just like you get what you want, only what you want, and lots of it, which is cool. But in a way, like you never challenge yourself to think about like, okay, well, why don't I like this? You just like, I don't like it, next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there is also kind of a deeper listening back then as a result, because if you're one CD a week, I usually would buy like one CD a week with all my allowance money. If that was all you got, you had to make do that week listening to that album and try to like it.
Also, I think being younger and being like a teenager, you're maybe more apt to be obsessed with a band.
I mean, I think it's interesting too, because like every Friday I pull up my phone, and that's when new music comes out now, and I just add like 6 records that have come out that maybe I haven't heard yet. It's a lot more rare for me to like go get a record and then like come home and like put it on and like sit there and listen mm-hmm. to it, you know, because of the way that we consume music now. Because of access to everything all the time. And so I think to Dan's point, it does devalue it a little bit. But it's like, I don't want to like sit here and say it's like bad, like, oh, because like access to all music is sweet. But where I think there is something that I don't know if it's been figured out yet. It's just like, how do you care about something? Or mm-hmm. like, how can you, with like information kind of constantly coming over you, what is it that will make you stay? Because before it was like, well, I spent $15 on this. Right. But now it's like, I already have it.
Dan, you were talking last week about how you still buy vinyl. What is the role of vinyl now? Yeah. Like, what's the purpose of it?
Well, it's funny because I do collect vinyl almost like accidentally. Like, I don't drink, but I imagine it's like buying vinyl is a lot like drinking, because like this morning I woke up and like I looked in my inbox and it was just like, thank you for your order from Discogs. And I was like, oh no, what did I do last night? And that's what I do. I stay up late and I order records, and then I wake up in the morning and I'm like, oh, I feel so bad about myself. But the ones that I do buy are just like stuff from, you know, yesteryear, before the internet, like especially like low print hardcore records that I buy, that because I'm like, it's not officially on the internet, so it can just mm-hmm. go away at any moment. So I'll buy those because I almost feel like this is a limited release of this music, that like if I don't own, like who's going to take care of these records, mm-hmm. like and these songs, and what happens to them?
Especially for independent artists, it's a nice gesture to buy the vinyl simply because they're surely not going to be getting any streaming revenue at all. Mm-hmm. Vinyl is extremely popular right now, but most vinyl production is represses of major label like classic albums that are sold in places like Urban Outfitters. Mm-hmm. So people are buying, I don't want to say they're buying more vinyl than ever before, but they're buying a lot of vinyl these days. But it's often strange, like collector's yeah. items that they may not even listen to.
People
they may
who just
not
want to frame them and put them in their
yeah,
living room.
Like put yeah, them on yeah. the mantel place.
Right.
And then that leads to a problem, tying back to your point, where a lot of smaller labels can't get access to record pressing plant
yeah.
facilities.
It takes like 4 months in advance to get your record pressed. And I think it's getting worse. Like everybody that I know that does like a indie label, like you said, it's just like feeling the squeeze of it, because like it's like, oh, actually your record's going to take 5 months to press because they had to repress the Clueless soundtrack for no, some reason, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is a good album, though.
Well, nobody's knocking the Clueless. I hate the player, not the game, all right?
Mm-hmm. Kind of to Dan's point, I do fear that like with how the great beast of capitalism works, that like all of the things that Dan's talking about, all what Emily was talking about, like these like kind of moments, little small interactions that you have with music as a fan are just going to become like obsolete. Like all people are going to care about is the biggest artist in the world or whatever. So like the fun like corners of consumption are going to be eliminated, and that is sad.
I don't know. Like I when you're putting out an album, you're thinking about it mm-hmm. in terms of like a whole object, like an art object, how it looks, how it sounds, in some cases even how it feels. Like you're talking about like, you know, this is going to be on like a matte black or versus like a shiny black, like things like that matter. And I feel like kids in the future probably won't care about that at all. Yeah. Like they'll just care about recordings.
Well, I mean, you wonder though, because then you also see an artist like Frank Ocean last year who was put out like probably one of the biggest albums of the year, sold a ton of records. was like number one on lists all around, number one on Noisy's list. And, you know, he put it out on vinyl and it sold out instantly. Like, yeah, it has a zine. Like, artists are doing what you're talking about, and it seems like fans are there to consume it and to buy it and all of that. But it doesn't change the fact that I'm still scared. Like, you know,
it sucks not to, like, you know, talk bad about Frank Ocean. It just sucks because, like, yeah, Frank Ocean did a cool thing, but that probably means, like Emily said, that, like,
exactly
100 small artists didn't get the chance to that year because the vinyl pressing plant. There is something like 3 vinyl pressing plants left in the country that, like, actively print records. Like, that's insane. And so you have, like, these 20 mega huge artists that can do whatever they want, and, like, you know, and this is nothing against their music, but, like, Beyonce and, like, Taylor Swift and Lorde and all these people get all the resources that, to put out their records, and, like, everybody else has to take a hit because there's only so many resources to put out there. So,
yeah, we're just going to lose something in that. And I think that, that music fans want it, but I just don't know if it would be able to be provided.
So Drew Milliard wrote that essay in the upcoming music issue about how sites like Spotify mean that artists can game the system by basically sort of figuring out what kind of song to make that will get the most hits, that will drive it up the charts, to get the most eyes and ears on it. And what does that mean for independent artists, and what that, and like how people actually make music?
There is this really weird fact in the piece where Drew spoke to someone who worked at a record label, and they said that often the recognizable idiosyncratic artists with a name on the label wouldn't have a track on the record that performed well algorithmically, and then a completely unknown up-and-coming artist on the label would somehow have music that was algorithmically friendly or algorithm friendly, and then they would generate much more revenue than like famous artists.
And not to be an idiot, but what makes a song like perform well on those kinds of services algorithmically?
I mean they don't release that information, but there's been stories of artists who sort of pick up on the, like, the artists do research about it, and then they try to pick up on like what's a sweet spot in terms of combining this sound and that sound. Something we spoke a lot about at Thump was the lo-fi house genre, which was sort of a chill wavy mix of house, like lo-fi house, and other kind of indie electronica. And the music that some of these producers were producing hit this middle ground of so many different desirable genres that they would rock it up and have, like, you know, tens of thousands of listens and these unknown artists. And yeah, I just wonder, will identity start to matter less in this new system? Obviously, as journalists, we're really focused on, you know, who are the artists who make the most distinctive music and have the most distinctive personal brand. But on this other really weird level, there's people who just make music that's successful, but nobody has ever heard of them. Mm-hmm. It's very strange.
Good algorithm trick. Just name your band the Rolling Stones.
Like, people do stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
People are doing stuff like that on Spotify.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's bad. I don't know. I mean, I think it's just like, I think algorithms are bad.
The Rolling Stones are bad. Eric Sunderman, Noisy Editor in Chief, on the record.
I love the idea that I can pull out my phone and listen to anything at any moment. It's like there is a lot of music that I have access to, but I would happily throw that away and like not have that if it could let us not provide our listening habits to people, provide data. To me, that's maybe the scariest part of it, is it's I'm showing every day my listening habits to these corporations who control art, and then they can market to me. The iPhone's only 10 years old, and like the amount of change that's happened between then and now is insane, and I think it's scary what's happening to music and art because of that.
I feel like starting in the late 2000s, a lot of very underground artists started taking advantage of social media to try to reach wider audiences. And there's this explosion of people who otherwise would have been kind of part of this like low-key underground counterculture trying to like work inside the commercial market. And, you know, why we receive articles from so many artists who are hiring publicists and trying to make like a big commercial go of what they're doing. And the weird thing is that there isn't enough room on publications to write about all this stuff. There aren't enough ears to listen to all this music, and very few artists are actually going to make revenues from what they're doing. So I wonder if there's going to be some sort of shift at some point where certain people like stop trying to play the system and decide to just really remain firmly in the underground.
Off the grid.
I think there will be. I mean, there's a generation of kids who want to buy like Frank Ocean zine. Like, I think that there's going to be a reaction to like get off of Facebook or get off of the internet. And I hope that it's just able to like sustain itself. You know, I think that's the thing that's scariest.
So crazy to read Luke Sante's piece that's also in this issue. Mm-hmm. He talks about being a young person in the late 70s and early 80s and what it was like back then. And he talks about how there was only like 100 people in the whole city that were part of the scene and were listening to this music. And there were a few record shops, and everyone would go to those record shops and a few bars. And obviously that it like stoked a nostalgia in me, and I wonder if the reason why it did that is because of like what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. I'm constantly thinking about how social media has changed the way that we think and changed the way that we perceive things. Like, we talk about like what New York was like in like the 70s, you know, and it was, people were just reading the Village Voice and going to shows. The reality is yeah, there were maybe like 100 people doing that, but the pressure that social media and the internet puts on you is to be thinking that like, oh, this is how everybody's thinking. And that's why Noisy has to write like a news article about Drake drinking a milkshake, you know, because like, we have to hit this huge readership that taps into like the mainstream. And it's like, you know, maybe at the end of the day, there's only like a certain amount of people who are going to be willing to like listen to music like we do, or listen, like, because it's a scene, it's small, it has identity. Like, that's the purpose. It's purposefully not mainstream. And so the way that having access to everything, it goes against the idea of being counterculture, because then it becomes culture, and therefore there's something there lost.
The Vice Magazine podcast is a production of Vice Media. For more info on the podcast or how to subscribe to the magazine, visit vice.com. And be sure to subscribe to the Vice Magazine podcast on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or any podcast app you use. Leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think. I'm Ellis Jones, and I'd like to give a special thanks to Emily Friedlander, Eric Sunderman, and Dan Ozzie. We'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.